At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Welcome. Dear readers, huge news. Quinn and I are in the same room. No, we're in the same house. We're in the same house. And I moved back in with her. I got rid of my apartment and I said, I'm moving back in.
But why? In this scenario.
I just thought you guys missed me. I think it was it wasn't for me. It was for you guys. This morning was amazing. I was invited to Griffin's stepping up ceremony, and it was really fucking cute. It was really, really fucking cute.
He really stepped up.
He stepped the fuck up. And I would say that to his face. He stepped the fuck up so hard. Seeing him walk in, did I get emotional? Yeah. Quinn, do you want to talk about your stress experience in the stepping up ceremony?
We went to pull Koa from class to watch the stepping up ceremony because it's his brother, same school building. And they were like, just so you know, if you pull him, you can't put him back. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, if you take him out of school to watch the stepping up ceremony, which is a 30-minute ceremony, you can't have him come back to class. And I was like, but it's Griff fucked. Can go back after he does the stepping up ceremony. And they're like, correct. Like,
yeah.
And I'm like, this feels like a prank and it feels mean. And why would you dissuade families from having siblings watch? That's so odd. So I had a heart attack, went back in the auditorium and was like, I guess we can't have Koa watch, which I was also mad at because I had told Koa in the morning he could watch. And then Matt was like, let's just pull him. And so Matt went and picked him up.
Well, both you and Matt were really going, what should we do? What should we do?
What should we do?
And then Matt was like, and you were like, you need to go now. And it stressed me out. I'll be honest. Yeah. I got stressed. And then
adrenaline spike.
And
it was nice that Koa went. And then Koa was kind of sad he couldn't go back to school. He was like, why'd you do that? And I was like, you know.
We made a call. And let that be a lesson to parenting.
I was like, would you have wanted to miss that? And he's like, yeah. He knew that it was the right call. He told me.
It was the right call.
He was like, no, I did want to see that. I'm like, yeah. Like, it's your brother, dude. Like, he's going to have, like, very few important things like this that we got to go and, like, show up for. And it mattered a lot to Griff that Koa was there. It was very cute.
He kept turning around and pointing. The biggest stress for me was that Matt is usually the cameraman, is the DP for the family. Mm-hmm. And he was getting Koa and the kids were marching in. And I had to get my phone and record a video of Griffin walking in because I couldn't, you know, I was afraid to miss it. And I was afraid that Matt wouldn't see it. So I felt like the responsibility. So I do have him walking in and his little face with his Robert Durst haircut. He is so cute and he was so happy. And he was being a little mischievous during the ceremony. He kept talking and turning around and it was
getting a little
really
bit in trouble.
It was really funny though. It was super cute. I like seeing a little kid who's being a little naughty.
He's being a little bit naughty.
A little bit naughty.
Well, we had a very jam-packed weekend. You were there for a lot of it.
I was.
Citywide hunt, but in addition,
it was so fun. It was stressful.
Fun. Wasn't it
so
cool?
Here's what it is. Quinn was working, can I say, for Great Gotham Challenge?
Yeah.
And they do this insane treasure hunt throughout the city. And I went with Matt, the two kids, and then their friends and their two kids. So we had four kids and we had five adults.
To be clear, it's not a kid thing at all.
It is not a kid thing at all. And it was really super duper fun. I'm going to say this with the love in my heart. I think it would have been easier without the kids. I do.
Well, yeah, of course. Do you want to know how you guys ranked?
We were fourth from the bottom and we took cheats. So it wasn't like, listen, I forgot I did this, but I took an edible before going, like half of an edible. I don't know what possessed me to do such a thing, but I like couldn't
focus. And then
I was like, I forgot. And I was like, that's why my mouth is so dry. And then afterwards,
we gave you ice cream and you were like, this is fine.
I was like, thank God. And then I just wanted a beer, but there was no place for a beer. And I like messed up whatever.
Did you guys have a beer?
No, we wanted, I'm sure they did at the finale. Was there a beer at finale?
No.
And nobody had a beer. So then after that, we got there at 1 o'clock and it was rainy. We got there at 1 o'clock and I had to go to a birthday party at the Brooklyn Cyclones, which was super fun. That started at 6. We didn't finish. I didn't know how long the show was, the adventure was going to be. With kids, it was longer than 5 hours.
It was so we're 6:30 is when your team came to the finish line.
And I said, I finished the puzzle. And then I was like, I have to go. I can't go to the final stand. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't do that. So I had to jet from there. And I took like a weird, like, glamour bus from Manhattan, peed in a Whole Foods, you know, and then went to the game. And at the game, I arrived like an hour, 15 minutes late. And part of my ticket was 4 drinks, a food item, and a hat.
4 drinks?
4 drink tickets.
That is insane.
So wait, get this. I thought it was a pretty fucking good deal. For $44, I got 4 drinks.
$44, stop at the drinks. That's a good deal.
A ticket and a hat. And so I get there, and my ass, though, I'm late, and they're going to stop serving beer at inning 6.5. And my cheap ass is like, I'm not fuck. And so
you ordered 4 beers.
Well, what happened was is I ordered 2 beers, and then they were finished, and the guy behind at the end of the line was like, on the end of the line, can't get in. And so I like walked around to this guy who was talking to a friend of mine who I didn't formally meet, and I was like, hey, could you give me this beer with this ticket? And he's like, yeah. And then I came back and I was like, I'm actually going to stand next to you because I feel weird about asking you. And then I also ordered another beer, and then I gave it to someone because I couldn't handle the idea of not getting all four. I'm not an idiot. I'm not wasting money on this. And then I took an edible that I shouldn't have taken, and I got really high. And then we left early because I was so tired. And I got home.
Quite a day.
And then I ate so much of my left. I just like ate everything and then went to sleep. But I like got home at 10:40 and I was like, I'm fucking exhausted. You went to a dance party and were dancing until 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, we were crazy just till midnight. But then we stayed up and watched TV and ate pizza till 1. We were like,
so we had the same schedule. We both ate pizza till like 1 o'clock.
Yeah, we both ate pizza at midnight, which feels important. Soul Sisters, it was really fun. It was really fun that Matt
and I. That's the dumbest thing you've ever said.
Totally. That Matt and I were so tired and we were like dancing like robots on our neighbor's porch who had like a fun disco light and sparklers. So it felt festive. And then, but we didn't really know anybody at that party. We only knew like 2 or 3 other people. So it was also funny because we showed up and we were like, let's do this. And we knew like 4 people there and we just like danced really hard. And then Matt's Father's Day gift was that he got to sleep until 11:30.
Oh,
and
a great gift.
Then it was a rainy day, so like nobody had guilt, which was like a fun feeling where like we played inside all day with the kids, but it was totally raining. And then we had friends over we had Brayden and Julie over, and so Brayden and Julie love watching scary movies, and so do I. So often we'll get together to watch a scary movie.
Fun.
And I had invited them over a long time ago and been like, do you guys want to come over and watch a scary movie on Friday the 13th? But they had plans. So they were like, what about Sunday? And I was like,
what about Father's Day?
Great.
And you said yes.
That's right. And then Julie kept calling Sunday. She kept saying, see you Friday the 13th. Observed.
What scary movie did you watch?
We started a TV show and we watched the first two episodes and it was called, actually, this is really interesting. I think it's British, even though they speak in American accents. Fiona Shaw is in it, speaking with an American accent.
We love.
And I think it was a UK made show that just became available in the US. So it was made like 8 years ago, but it's like a new release here. And it's called Channel Zero. And it takes a creepy pasta and turns it into a 6-episode series. So they take all their favorite creepy pastas. The first season is a creepy pasta called, I wanted to say Clover Club. It's something else with two C's that is like a scary television show from the 80s that somebody remembers, but no adults ever saw. And you had to turn past all the channels and get snow to get it. And kids start disappearing. It's very, very scary. And what I'm really excited about, I don't know if listeners will remember, season 2, the scary creepypasta they're doing is No End House. And I don't know if you remember, but years ago, many moons ago, I did No End House as one of my stories. Like, it's a creepypasta. It's not real. But it is so scary that when I read it, I was like, I have to share this scary story. It's one of those ones where each room is progressively scarier.
Oh, I remember.
And then there was
this.
The story, yes, of like basically leaving the house and
it's basically
having
over.
A feeling that you are like,
your world has changed.
Yes. Like basically like leaving. There being a scary thing where you feel like you left, but you didn't. But the idea that he's like, even now as I'm writing this, things feel off and I can't tell if this is reality or if I'm still in the house.
I really like that.
Yeah. So that's going to be a really fun season too. And Fiona Shaw's in this season and she's amazing.
She's incredible.
Although an American accent on her, awkward. Like maybe just because I'm like, she can do anything, but I'm like, this feels wrong.
But
like,
can part, she do that?
It's part of the scary. It's part of like the Shelley Duvall effect where you can't tell why you're uncomfortable, but you certainly are.
Is that a well-known documented thing, the Shelley Duvall effect?
No, but I always think of how like just her presence in The Shining is so uncomfortable. And when she's smoking and
bangs.
Her ash gets as long as a finger and she doesn't ash it and you're like holding your breath, you're like, ah, Shelley Duvall.
I've never seen The Shining, so I actually wouldn't know.
Oh, by the way, did I ever tell you about the time that I was talking to one of Koa's friend's parents? And he was like, well, it's kind of a hard weekend. I have to go to my aunt's funeral. And then it turned out his aunt was Shelley Duvall.
No.
Wild,
you didn't,
right?
Tell me that?
Very
That's
wild.
Crazy.
I was
also,
like, I love your aunt.
Also, I totally forgot. I was talking to Jordan. I saw Jordan and the new baby and Fern is so cute. She's so little sweet. I was there on Friday night and she sleeps and I got to hold her. And when she sleeps, she just goes, the whole time. So sweet and so cute. And at one point we were talking and I think she was like, well, yeah, you know that Shirley Temple is Matt's mom's aunt.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. That's fucking insane. Do we have to cut that? Have we told the listeners that? That's crazy.
It's a true story.
Hey, it's a true story.
Matt, my husband's great aunt is Aunt Shirley Temple.
Is deceased. Shirley fucking R.I.P. Temple. What the fuck? I forgot about that completely. And I felt like weirdly when Jordan brought it up, I felt hoodwinked. I was like, why don't I know that? Why isn't that
you
not
do
at the
know
tip
that.
Of my...
You do know
I
that.
I forgot. No.
Maybe you
no.
don't. I don't know.
I did
it's
know
possible.
That, but
you don't,
I forgot.
We don't run around and tell people because the truth is it's not, first of all, she's not around anymore. Second of all, it's not like he was like sitting on her lap every Sunday afternoon having her read him stories. It was his great aunt. Like,
well, I'm close with my great aunts, but at the same point in time, I got to say, that's like having an uncle named, I don't know, Mai Tai. I just feel like, you know, that there's my great uncle, Arnold Palmer. That's like having Arnold
Palmer. So weird.
It's a famous drink.
Truly addicted. I was like truly addicted to Shirley Temples as a kid. Loved a Shirley Temple. Like would always want one. And I don't think my kids have ever had one, nor would they like it because they don't like bubbles. They don't like bubbles. But
they haven't tried like the sweet, sweet sugar.
You're right.
Maybe it's the sugar.
Get them a Shirley Temple?
I'm gonna fucking give your kids diabetes if you don't stop me. Although
well,
I didn't
I think that's
bring
a good
any
place
fun treats
to loop us back into some stories here,
because I have a long story today, but we have to thank two Patreons. By the way, you're listening to Truly
Darkly
Creepily. I want to thank for the first time today. It's Dana. Is it rhymes with banana? Dana. Thank you. They put that in the Patreon description. Dana, you're a star. We love you so much. You are such a star. Your name rhymes with banana. I don't know why I keep saying that, but Dana, you're the Rama of a banana and
Dana,
a llama.
Dana, peel you like a banana. Take all your skin off your body. You're just bones. You're just muscle. You're dancing around. It's really disgusting, but it's definitely darkly. It's definitely creepily.
It's walking very around, true.
Doing a peeply. Can see your whole body. It's got no skin. Why don't I begin again?
Dana.
Because it was bad.
Did you like the
song?
I'm
really, really sad. I'm sad that this happened to you, Dana.
Dana. Thank you so much, Dana. We love to see that. Thank you for putting rhymes with banana. That was so helpful. Thank you. The next
But could
person...
you give us more words next time so that
banana,
we don't have to think on our feet?
Fana. Dana. Lana. Banna. Coco Cabana. Dana loves the Coco Cabana. She has a drumstick and drums on the banjo.
Close. Sure.
Close. Okay.
No, sure.
The next
fine.
One, they did not give me a reference for their name.
Oh, brother.
But I'm going to say, is it Stacy or Snot? It's just Stacy.
Or Stassi. Should we sing a song
or
for Stassi?
It's definitely not Stassi. But is it Stacy or is it Stacy? Is it like ecstasy? Stacy is your name, like ecstasy. You probably are mood changer. We love you. You're so fun. You make us happy. Stacy, you're not a mom. Or are you a mom? Because Stacy's mom has got it going on. But that's about your mom. That's not about you. Stacy, you are a hottie.
Stacy is the Patreon that's got it going on. Stacy, you're so beautiful that I want to lacy your drink with something and take
Quinn, no.
you home.
Quinn, no.
Stacy, I love your facey. That's why I laced this my tie.
Truly Darkly Creepily does not condone lacing any drinks. I have to make a comment. Quinn, recently the songs have been very drug-centric.
Mm.
We had someone named Molly, and you kept talking about how Molly's your favorite drug, which I don't know if that's the case or not, but
it's
like you really
not.
Are.
I don't think I have the background in Molly to offer that viewpoint. It went fine the time I took it and I was 17.
I've never taken Molly. That Oprah episode of them being like, look at this brain. It has scoops out. I was like, I don't want that to happen to me. Again, I'm one of the few people that DARE actually worked on.
Sing it loud, sing it proud.
But
sister.
If we had a name, if we had someone by the name of Vushroom, that I think you'd say. You'd like, that is my favorite drug.
I'd be like, hold up.
Mushroom.
Yeah,
that's a
today?
Fun you do. That's a fun prank. Hey, bye, if anyone wants to prank us in like a really funny way, you should join Patreon and just have your name be Mushroom. What a fun joke. Let's see how many people
see what
join
we
Patreon.
Do. Try, just trying to get do. That money. Will they see through it?
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
This is the story of Michael Joseph Swango. Ranker, Wikipedia, Columbus Monthly, All That's Interesting, and Crime Library. Michael Swango was born in Tacoma, Washington, and I don't know a ton about his upbringing other than he was a middle child. His dad was a depressed alcoholic. I think he had probably PTSD. He served in Vietnam, then drank a lot, then got divorced. So Michael grows up mostly with just his mother, and he's very close to her. He plays the clarinet. He's the valedictorian of his school. And when he leaves, he tries to go to Millikan University College, but sophomore year, not really into it. Yeah, but he quits. He gets really into scrapbooking, pictures of accidents and military coups and sex crimes and things like that. And then he's like, this is more interesting than school. I'm just going to leave and I'm going to join the Marine Corps because maybe I'll see some crazy shit, which he doesn't really. And then he's honorably discharged in 1980 and goes to Quincy University. One thing that he does carry over from the Army, which is weird because Quincy University, he's like going and studying like chemistry and stuff. And in fact, he is a top student and he graduates summa cum laude and was given the American Chemical Society Award. So he's overachieving. But when he screws something up in class, he'll drop and do push-ups. I would feel weird about that personally.
You know, interestingly enough, someone on the softball team that I am on apparently does the same thing. I haven't seen it, but when he like hits a ball and he like gets angry, it's a way to channel your rage. And also,
okay,
yep, I don't know that. That seems, but in school during like a chemistry quiz, that seems
distracting. And like all these science nerds and you have this guy that's like, ugh! Like, I don't know. It's not what I picture. But then he goes to Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. And everyone that encounters him there says that he is a very competitive student, but not a good student necessarily. I think he makes very good grades, but they remember things like they'd be in class and it'd be like, all right, everybody, show us where the human heart is on this X-ray. And he couldn't. And they're like, you should have learned that a long time ago. So it feels like he has no reason to be arrogant, but he definitely is. Another alarm bell is that he dissects a dead body, a cadaver for class, yes. And he tears the shit out of it. Like in a way where everybody makes fun of him and talks about it and it becomes a little bit school lore, how weird that was. And he loves being near talking about death. Anything, if there's a critical patient that they're speculating about, that's what he's mostly interested in. And when they're working in hospitals, he would write died when somebody died in big red letters on the chart. And people would be like, that's really intense. Do you think maybe that's a little bit cold? And he'd be like, hey, death happens.
Could improve bedside manner. Could improve his bedside manner.
A lot of the other students realize that whenever he's on the case as an intern, people are dying, and so they start calling him 00 Swango. His name is Michael Swango, 00 Swango, which is a James Bond reference, which is because they say he has a license to kill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of the patients that he gets assigned end up dead. And then a month before he's supposed to graduate, they realize that he faked doing his OBGYN rotation, which I love. Like, he's really into death and everything. And they you know, it's like when you're in med school, you have to do everything. And he just pretended to do the OBGYN thing where they go in to see the pregnant woman. And she's like, he didn't do anything. He didn't even take my blood pressure. But he filled out a full chart like he did. So in his last year, they're like, that's not great. We don't know what we're going to do. Meanwhile, in this last year of school, his dad dies. He goes home and his mom's like, let me give you this. It's a scrapbook your dad made. And it's the same kind of scrapbook he made. Like all kinds of accidents and things like that and disasters. And so he keeps that scrapbook and starts building upon that. And somebody asks him what that's all about. And he says, if I'm ever accused of murder, This will prove I'm mentally unstable. What a strange thing to say, Michael Swango.
Wow.
So once the fake checkup thing with the OBGYN gets discovered, things are up in the air. People are questioning whether he's been faking a lot more of the degree and to what degree, if you'll excuse the turn of phrase. So they think about expelling him, but then there's a committee, and the way the committee works is they would all have to agree, and they don't. So somebody's like, let's give this guy a second chance. And they graduate him, but then everywhere he applies to work, a letter from the dean comes that says no. Like, basically, I can't vouch for this kid. But somehow he still gets accepted into an internship program at Ohio State University Medical Center in 83. And he wants to become a neurosurgeon. And the residents
Seems like a pretty complex specialty for someone who barely graduated.
Yeah, it's alarming. But they he's very say, arrogant. He thinks he can do anything. He's a play God kind of guy you're going to find.
Okay, Dunning-Kruger guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of these. So all the people that work with him are right away feeling like Swango is a weird guy. And he talks a lot about Nazi history. He talks a lot about things like that. And
like eugenics and stuff?
Yeah, and his behavior with patients is so checked out, like very antisocial, the bedside manner, very bizarre, very disconnected. And then in January of 84, he goes into a patient's room to check on her IV, and the nurse is like, this is off. It shouldn't be an intern that checks, and it should have been performed earlier. There's all these alarm bells, and she leaves the room because he tells her to, but then she comes back after he leaves and sees the person has turned blue, and she has to do all these life-saving measures, and she recovers. But then a week later, there's a low reading on somebody's central venous pressure gauge that that puts medicine in their IV, and they call a doctor, and the intern Michael Swango comes, and again, after he leaves, this person is blue, and then they die. And he just stares at them, watches them die. And as they're dying, the nurse gives them mouth to mouth, and he goes, that's so disgusting.
Oh, dear.
It's all within a month. It's like January 31st, February 6th, and now, still February 6th, the next day, also known as February 7th. there's a nurse that goes to check on her elderly patient who had an operation and is in recovery and sees him injecting this patient. And then she codes and she recovers and she can't speak. And they bring her pen and paper and she writes on it, someone gave me some med in my IV and paralyzed all of me, lungs, heart, speech. And they're like, it was Swango. He was just in here. And he's like, I was never in there. And they're like, you were. This person saw you in there. This person saw you run out and look weird. This person saw you go in the bathroom looking crazy. And this person found an empty needle in the bathroom that had been just rinsed with water. So everyone is suspicious of him, but nothing is happening. But there have been, besides these three I mentioned, six others that have mysteriously died or coded when he's the one by their bedside, when they're under his care. And he'll sometimes say he found them dead. One time he finds a guy dead and they look later and somebody had just pushed gauze into his throat. That's how he had died.
That's murder.
Sometimes it's injecting people, but sometimes it's just as clumsy as that and it's just to kill them. But no one can prove that it's happening.
Oh my God.
Then he gets transferred to work in the surgery department and people are hemorrhaging. People are getting clots in their organs. Again, it's this, people won't even be there for serious reasons. There's like a 22-year-old there recovering from something and he gives her an injection and she dies. Like, asks her mom to leave the room, injects her with something. She dies. He comes out of the room and he just says to the mom, she's dead now. You can go look at her. Can you imagine being that mother?
I can't. Oh my God.
it's not even just the patients. He brings in a bucket of fried chicken for everybody, for all the doctors.
No.
And they all get sick, and some are vomiting so much their blood vessels are bursting in their eyes. And so they do an investigation, but in 1984, they can't connect him to anything. But it's enough that they do not want him around. So they give him letters of recommendation that help him get his medical license, because they're afraid he'll sue them, and they get him out of there. It's this pass the buck thing we've seen before. And he goes back to Quincy, Illinois, and he gets a job as an emergency medical technician with an ambulance service. And he loves it. He absolutely loves working for the ambulance. He says he loves working as a doctor because it gives me an opportunity to come out of the emergency room with a hard on to tell some parents that their kid has just died.
He doesn't say this at the time.
He says it
after the fact.
He says it to coworkers. He says that sentence and they're like, "Haha, what?" And then they're all sitting around one night in a cafeteria and he's like, "You know my fantasy? Picture a school bus crammed with kids, smashing head on with a trailer truck loaded down with gasoline, and we're summoned and we get there in a jiffy just as another gasoline truck rams the bus and it goes up in flames and kids are thrown through the air. On telephone poles, on the street, especially along an old barbed wire fence along the road, all burning." He says this to a group of people.
What the fuck?
And so they're keeping their distance, but then he brings in a box of donuts and they can't help but try one. And of course, everybody gets super fucking sick. But they right away are like, "He didn't have a donut, right?" "Right. I didn't see him have a donut. Okay, what are we going to do?" And they get a big pitcher of iced tea and they put it in the break room. They make sure he knows it's there and they leave it alone. Then after they know he's been to the break room, they take the iced tea and they send it in for testing, and it tests positive for an ant poison that is primarily made with arsenic. So the police now have a warrant. They search his house. They find a mini lab inside with a bunch of different poisons, including that rat poison and cyanide and all kinds of things. So in August of 85, he's convicted of aggravated battery for poisoning everybody, or trying to, and he's sentenced to 5 years. Then everyone's looking back at what the hospital did and how they helped get his license. And they're like, "You should have called the police. You should have said something." So he spends 2 of those 5 years in prison. When he gets out, he changes his name. And if people find out that he has a battery conviction in his past, he says it's a bar fight. And so then he gets a job as a counselor at the State Career Development Center in Virginia. But then I believe he's only there very briefly because they find his scrapbook at work, you know, his famous scrapbook, and he's working on it during work hours. But also they don't love the scrapbook, I'm sure. So they're like, "Beat it." He becomes a lab tech at Newport News for ATI Coal. And when he's working there, a lot of his coworkers get sick when he gives them stuff to eat and drink. And he meets...
I would be dead. I always eat the free food. I'd be
gone. For sure. He meets and falls in love with Kristen Lynn Kinney, whatever him falling in love looks like. She's a nurse at Riverside Hospital. And so they're planning to get married. In 1991, he changes his name legally to Daniel J. Adams and tries to get a residency program at Ohio Valley Medical Center in Virginia. In July of 92, he starts to work at Sanford USD Medical Center in South Dakota. And he does both of those. So he gets both those gigs by forging all kinds of documents. It's basically he forges a ton of different documents to create a completely different story of his life. It works. And because it works, he's now flying too close to the sun. And he's like, "I'm going to go and join the American Medical Association." But they do really serious background checks. So when they check, they find out about the poisoning and they're like, "Absolutely not." And then the Discovery Channel gets word of this crazy story. And on Thanksgiving, they do a segment about him. And then people see the segment about him. He gets fired. Meanwhile, all this stress, his wife is having horrible headaches, or his would-be wife. I can't remember if they get married or not. I think they didn't get married, but they're still together. She's having horrible headaches, and she can't hack it. She moves home to Virginia. Obviously, as soon as she is away from Michael, her headaches stop. But that is so overwhelming for her because she's truly in love with him.
Ugh.
So she's completely overwhelmed by that and does not know how to cope. Meanwhile, the AMA, who's been after Swango after they figured out that he's this nut trying to work everywhere, he is gone. They can't find him anywhere. It somehow where he is ends up being, this is wild, he has a psychiatric residency at Stony Brook University in New York. Oh my God.
Where do you go to school?
And he's seen patients there who are now dying for no reason. A lot of them are vets, and because he's in that department. And it's really sad. It's stories about this guy that's like joking with his wife in the waiting room. He just is there for pneumonia and he's totally fine. And then he dies of paralysis of the heart. And that just keeps happening. People are like, I just saw my loved one and they were fine and they were in recovery and they had something really minor. And then they're dying of heart failure or paralysis. And every time they're dying, they go to look at the chart and there's a do not resuscitate order that's been ordered by Michael Swango.
When does he get caught? For
this poor woman that he was going to marry, who I told you is just like so overwhelmed by this series of events, she kills herself. And she leaves a note for her parents that says, I love you both so much. I just didn't want to be here anymore. Just found day-to-day living a constant struggle with my thoughts. I'd say I'm sorry, but I'm not. I feel that sense of peace of mind I've been looking for, and it's nice. And then she has a little thing to Michael below that says, I love you more. You're the most precious man I've ever known. Her mom is freaked. Her dad is freaked. They're especially freaked because they're feeling like Michael Swango, who did something to their daughter and now she's dead, even if he wasn't a direct hand in it, he is a direct hand in other things and he's being allowed to practice medicine. So they take it upon themselves to blow the whistle and they're making all these calls. And Stony Brook, they finally get a hold of and the dean is like, what? So they fire him. And because they didn't do a good job vetting, they have to willingly, a lot of the higher ups have to resign that they let this guy in and people are dying. Right. So the dean resigns. He goes down in a blaze of glory, though, because he sends letters to 125 medical schools and 1,000 teaching hospitals saying, this is the guy. Do not have him. Look out for this guy. He's dangerous. And because it was in a veterans facility that a lot of his most recent crimes happened, it becomes federal. So now the FBI is looking at him. They find him in Atlanta working as a chemist at a wastewater facility, which feels scary. He flees the country, goes to Zimbabwe, uses forged documents to get a job at a Lutheran mission hospital there. And there's a bunch of stories of people dying there where there's somebody waking up when they're asleep and seeing him inject them and then wave to them in the dark, like, bye bye. And then suddenly they'll feel their whole body heat up. Then they'll feel barfy. Then they'll feel paralyzed. And then if they're able to be resuscitated against Michael Swango's plan, they'll be like, that guy tried to kill me. And they won't get rid of him. And then he'll be like, no, please, I'm a doctor. Like, this person was in a delirium. He'll do it to a pregnant woman while she's giving birth, inject her with something when no one's paying attention, but the pregnant woman will know. She'll tell everybody and they won't believe her. He'll be like, it was the height of the moment. Oh my, like, God, she was clearly delusional. So he's just, there's like a really sad story about this guy that's in there talking to friends, and he comes into the guy's room and tells all the friends, you guys have to leave. And then he's alone with the patient. And then everybody hears their friend screaming. And then they come in and he's screaming, that guy just injected me with something. And then he dies that afternoon. It's like, it's too late. Can you imagine, like, knowing full well what's happening? He's fired from that job, tries to work for free in the interim, and is like, let me just work for free even. It'll be fine. And they're like, no, we have a bad feeling. One of the doctors is like, I feel off about this guy. I keep seeing him creeping around when he's not even supposed to be at work. We're not going to do that. He rents a room from a widowed woman who gets really sick after he cooks her some food. She goes to a surgeon. The surgeon's like, I think it's arsenic poisoning, takes her hair sample, finds out it is. They're calling, they're taking that lab report, and Interpol and FBI are being informed by the Zimbabwe Republic police. So they come to Zimbabwe. He crosses the border to Zambia and then to Namibia, and he gets a job at the Royal Hospital in Saudi Arabia. He's just going everywhere. He's like, I'll just keep going. Fake resume. But then he flies back to the U.S. and they get him. He's flying through Chicago or something and they catch him. They know that this guy's a serial killer. They have no idea how they're going to prove it. What they can do is take all the forged documents and charge him with that right now. Then his sentence is 3 years. Then while he's serving time, that gives them a ticking time clock of 3 years to try to get any of these murders clear. Like, prove it, prove it, prove right. it. And they're basically able to do that with three of them. So they come to him and they're like, God, we're going to charge you with these. Zimbabwe's coming after you as well. They have shit. What do you want to do? And he's like, I want a plea deal. They're like, great. Accept life in prison, no parole, and plead guilty to these three murder counts. And he does. In the court case, they find this notebook of his, like a journal, and they read stuff from it, where he talks about how he killed for pleasure, where he talks about how he loved the sweet, husky, close smell of indoor homicide, and that the murders were the only way he could remind himself that he's alive. He is sentenced in 2000 to three life terms without the possibility of parole. And he's serving this in Florence at his request, which seems weird. I'm like, why did you let him request anything? But maybe it was part of the plea deal. And then somebody wrote this book, not somebody, James B. Stewart wrote a book, Blind Eye, and said, there is circumstantial evidence that leads us to believe he's linked to 35 suspicious deaths, but the FBI thinks it could be as many as 60. And that would make him one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And that's the story of Michael Joseph Swango.
The poor families. That's heartbreaking.
So sad.
Ugh. Ugh. And you know it's because these hospitals are afraid of getting sued and... Oh, God. It's awful. They could have stopped him so much earlier.
That's always so the story. Earlier. And that feeling of, like, the earliest person seeing something, and if they had said something then, if you do the calculation of how many lives saved, it's so terrifying.
Ugh, makes me fucking sick. What was the part that you laughed at when you were researching? Was the fried
chicken?
That
he tried to get out of the OBGYN rotation? Because I just loved picturing this serial killer that's like, I am not doing vagina stuff.
That's actually gross.
He's murdering people. When he sees mouth to mouth, he's like, that's nasty. Like, he's kind of a squeamish guy when you break it down. Just about certain things.
Quinn and I were researching our cases next to each other, and she started giggling. And I was like, what are you laughing at? She's like, sorry, there's just a funny moment. It's a really dark story. It's a really dark story, but there's just a funny moment. I'm sorry. You're right there, champ. Yeah. Okay. This is a long one, so I got to go. I got this information from Texas Monthly with support by Wikipedia. It's 1989 and it's spring break. Mark Kilroy is 21 years old and he goes to the University of Texas at Austin. He is a pre-med student. just a little bit of background. He's born in Chicago. His family's moved to Texas, where he grows up in Santa Fe, Texas. He's a really good student. He was in the Boy Scouts, honors student. He was in student council. Like, he ended up playing, I think, basketball at a couple other universities and ended up transferring to University of Texas at Austin. And it's spring break, and Mark is planning to go to South Padre Island, which is right along the Texas coastline, and it's a short drive away from the Mexican border. So he's planning on going with three of his best friends. He's going with Bradley Moore, who he grew up with. He went to high school with him, and also Bill Huddleston and Brent Martin. So the plan is this. The four of them are talking like, we're going to have so much fun. This is going to be like, they're juniors. They're talking about their last summer at home together that upcoming summer. Brad finishes his finals first. He goes to Texas A&M. He then drives to Austin to pick up Mark. Then the two of them drive down to Santa Fe to pick up Bill and Brent, and the four boys are together. They're just four cute boys, clean cut, looking for spring break. None of them use drugs. They're all serious students. Texas Monthly has said in this article that was written in 1989, they were like, these are the kind of guys you'd want your daughter to date. And hey, maybe even marry. So they drive down to South Padre Island, which is a 9-hour drive. They check in the morning at the Sheraton on South Padre. That's where they're staying. And this is the beginning of spring break season. So when they arrive, the lobby has cleared all of the furniture because they're like, wow, all these kids are coming and we have to be prepared. This was going to be a well-attended area for spring break. There was talks of beer companies sponsoring entertainment, free movies, free concerts, free calls home because it's the 80s. So I guess you're calling for long distance. Surf simulators. There's also religious organizations who are handing out pamphlets and free sunscreen, urging people to pray and not party. Holler. Beer companies are offering the use of their swimming pool in exchange for being filmed for beer commercials. And the boys are like, this is great. Let's take advantage of all of this. They even like used the free long distance call to call their parents. Mark and Bradley did. I don't know if they did the praying part, but they definitely partied. The first night they meet some gals who went to Purdue. Shout out to an Indiana school. I went to IU. Our arch nemesis is Purdue, but they had a good time. They partied till dawn. I guess they had a conjoined hotel room, so it must have been fun. And then the guys were like, hey, we have a routine for this vacation. We're going to wake up, tan, catch some rays. Then after lunch, what they would do is they would go to the Sheraton Hotel where there was a Miss Tan Line contest. So it was where gals would go up and show off their tan lines. And apparently the cops were like, do not take your top off. And so the crowd went berserk. Mm-hmm. And then what they would do is they would go take a nap maybe or try to rest before they would go and party. So the first night they were there, they traveled down to Matamoros, which is in Mexico. It's right across the border. So what they would do is they, in this night, they drove down and they stopped at Sonic. They met some girls from University of Kansas, and then they caravaned together to Brownsville, which is in Texas, and then they parked the car, and then they would walk across the International Bridge on foot and spent the night partying in Mexico. The first night, they were at a place called Sergeant Pepper's. They all came back, lather, rinse, repeat. They do the same thing the next morning. Same deal. They tan. They go to Miss Tan Line, which Mark ends up chatting with one of the contestants. They go to sleep. Then they end up going to a condo party that his former frat brothers are throwing. And then at 10:30, they do the same thing. They go back to Matamoros and they walk across, or they go to Brownsville. They walk across to Matamoros in Mexico. Now, this place in Matamoros is like known for its cheap drinks, good times, and very lax drinking laws. The area is relatively safe for white folks or gringos, as this article depicted. But there is a history of gang activity and drug cartels, right? So the sort of big gang around there is the Hernandez family gang, where they're selling marijuana. So there has been a history of shootouts. There's been abductions. There was one story where a cop was tailing some of the Hernandez family, and he was following this guy, El Dubi, and who's a member of the gang, and then the cop disappears. But none of this stuff really affects the white folks. I think that's intentional, right? They try to separate the two. So This night they go back to Matamoros, and the town is in full swing. The spring breakers have arrived. In fact, there are like 15,000 spring breakers descending upon this small town. The first stop they go to is Los Sombreros because there's a short wait list. There's a lot of music. It's bumping. And then they go to another spot called the London Pub. It's more chaotic. They said that beer cans are being sprayed and thrown from the balcony. Mark ends up meeting some gals. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and one of the guys, Bill's like, hey, let's head back. And that's when they left, and they found Mark leaning against a car talking to the girl from the Miss Tan Line contest, which is all very fun and exciting. But they're walking back through the main drag. People are leaving the bars. They're stumbling across the bridge. Bradley and Brent walk ahead, and Mark stops in front of a house to say goodbye to this Miss Tan Line contestant. Bill remembers...
I love that you keep calling her that.
I don't know her name. I think it just goes to show that Mark was a cute guy and he was talking to this girl and, you know, they're just four guys looking for a fun time. And so Bill remembers Mark asking him, like, if everything's okay, why he wants to go home. And Bill's like, listen, I'm just not in a partying mood. I'm just feeling tired. And Mark's like, all right, let's go. The two other guys are ahead of them. And Bill's like, I got to go take a sneaky pee. So he runs around the corner. And when he comes back, Mark is gone. And so he thinks maybe he caught up with the other two. So he runs up to the other two guys and he's like, did you see Mark? And they're like, no, but he's got to be around here somewhere. So they go and they look through all the bars until the bars have been closed down. So Mark's nowhere to be seen. And they're trying to think, where's Mark? So then they go, okay, maybe he crossed the bridge with Miss Tanline. Maybe he's waiting by the car. So they go by the car. He's not there. They go, okay, maybe he caught a ride back to the hotel. Maybe he's spending the night out somewhere. We don't know. They go back to the hotel. They fall asleep. They wake up the next morning. Mark is still gone. So that's when they call the police and they issue a missing persons report. This wasn't uncommon in this area around spring break. In fact, police got all these calls and they were like, oh, usually people come back hungover and with a hazy memory if they come home. In fact, he was one of 60 people who had disappeared the first 3 months of 1989. So they're like, it's fine. However, Mark's family is pretty well connected. His uncle works for the U.S. Customs Service in L.A., and he's like, okay, no, this is not normal. And he puts pressure on the police force in Brownsville, Texas to search. And at that point, Matamoros, Mexico, is worried about the publicity from this U.S. case and like what it will do to tourism and all that stuff. And so they start looking in the case. They're trying to put the blame on Mark, saying that he was lost in Brownsville, not in Matamoros. The friends deny that. And then it's not long after that Mark doesn't show up that they're like, okay, maybe something is wrong. And at this point they think, hey, maybe there was some foul play involved. Maybe it was a drug related crime. Maybe it was a robbery gone wrong. Maybe it was a robbery killing. And at this point, Mark's parents come down and they're searching for their son. They've handed out 20,000 handouts with a $15,000 reward attached to it in both Texas and in Mexico. They're desperate for any information, and so they end up putting his friend under hypnosis and seeing who he was, if he can recall any information that maybe he doesn't readily remember. And he says he recalls Mark talking to a Hispanic man in a blue plaid shirt with a visible scar before he disappeared. And then they start canvassing the area, thinking that maybe, like, if it was possibly a robbery or a kidnapping, they're like, well, probably isn't a kidnapping because they haven't gotten a ransom. So they start looking at the area for a body. Texas officials and Mexico officials are trying to work with each other and trying to get as much information out as possible. And Mark is nowhere to be seen. It's March 26th, and the case is on America's Most Wanted with information. His parents, after spending weeks down in Mexico and in Brownsville, they return home and their community raises money through garage sales and car washes so they can continue the search. They drive to Austin and they withdraw Mark from school. It's April 1st, 1989, and a big break comes in. The police at the time are manning a drug checkpoint area where cars should stop to be checked for drugs, and a car just doesn't stop and keeps going through. And so the police, instead of turning on their lights and following them, they decide not to pursue them visibly, but they have an unmarked vehicle follow them. The vehicle is followed and it goes to a ranch in Santa Elena, which is not far from Matamoros. And the police pull to the side and are watching this car go in the ranch. And then 30 minutes later, it goes out of the ranch. And they see that the driver of this car is this guy called Serafin Hernandez Garcia. He's the nephew of a local drug lord. They do not arrest him. They just start to collect information. So the first thing they do is they look at the ranch. When they walk into the ranch, they're able to find traces of marijuana. They also see evidence of cult paraphernalia. In the Texas Monthly, they say there's this shed on the property. It just looks like a shed. They see melted candles, cigar butts. They see these empty bottles and a greasy cauldron. And the Mexican cops see something else that the American cops wouldn't see. They see a place where black magic was practiced. The cauldron, they will later find, has blood of animals and humans. And so they report this to their comandante. And the American authorities want to pursue the case about Mark's disappearance. But the comandante is, hey, we're not continuing this case until the black magic is neutralized. So the comandante stops the search until a curandero is summoned to chase out the demons. So the white magician, this curandero, comes and brings in white candles, peppers, and garlic. And it's at this point in the Texas Monthly article that it talks about in Mexican culture, there's these Christianity and there's these ancient indigenous religions, and the two of them are married together, and it created this sort of like magical Christianity where both are practiced, especially in this area of Mexico. So it's April 9th, and they have enough information on Serafin, the man that they followed in the car, where they arrest Serafin, his uncle, and a bunch of other guys, including the ranch's caretaker. They start to interview the group, and the group is very calm. They're like not stressed about being arrested. They feel invincible in a lot of ways. And they show a picture of Mark Kilroy to the ranch caretaker. And he tells the police, oh yeah, I saw him, and points to that shed on the ranch. It's at this point that Serafin admits that not only is Mark Kilroy dead, but that they've killed multiple people there over the course of 7 months. This is, like I said, this Hernandez family is a big drug gang. However, this gang is under the guidance of a cult whose leader is this guy, Adolfo Constanzo, who's a 26-year-old Cuban-American who was born in Miami. And as a teenager, he started practicing the Palo Mayombe religion, which initially involved animal sacrifice. As an adult, this Constanzo, he moves to Mexico City and he starts a business casting spells to bring luck and protection. And a part of this is him making money, and he has sacrifices, and they're very expensive sacrifices of animals. So he sacrifices chickens, goats, snakes, zebras, and even lion cubs. It's at this point that he graduates to human bones. At first, he starts to grave rob and use old bones, and then it progresses to human sacrifice. They call him the Godfather. Constanzo, he would often frequent the gay bars, and he was a powerful, charismatic guy. He started working with a gal, Sara Aldrete, who was born in Matamoros. However, she would go to high school in Brownsville, Texas, and she became a legal resident and attended Texas Southmost College. She's 6'1", long brown hair, and is studying physical education. Now, what's important to note is she ends up meeting Constanzo, and he introduces her to witchcraft and dark magic, and she has the nickname of Godmother. So she's like a big high up in this cult. She's a follower of the Godfather. And someone who went to college with her will later say, she sat in my anthropology class all semester, an A student, always present, always friendly. I never saw her wear an emblem, an amulet, a talisman, any sign of black magic, and I'm trained to watch for such things. Never heard her ask a weird question, even when we talked about weird religions. So at this point, Constanzo is now guiding the Hernandez family and having them practice Palo Mayombe. And their lives gets better initially, right? So, mm-hmm. for example, and this is just like an interesting anecdote, Serafin, the nephew of the big drug lord who they followed, mm-hmm. his grades improved after they started practicing this religion. And what's really fascinating, why I want to comment on this, is because he attends Texas Southmost College, and he is a law enforcement major. And he is participating in these human sacrifices. So,
what?
It escalates Wild. So much that Constanza, the godfather, he says in order for them to have protection from the police, to be immune from the law, to go completely protected, that they need a brain of a white Anglo male to sacrifice. Oh, so Serafin and a bunch of other members go to Matamoros during spring break, where they have their pick of the litter. And Mark Kilroy is in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah.
And we want your brain.
And he wants, but yeah, yeah. And they found him isolated. It's so crazy. When Bill is around the corner, they lure him to the truck. They grab him. They wrestle him into the truck. The members take him away. They stop. One of them has to pee. Mark makes a run for it. He's handcuffed. Mm-hmm. He runs out of the car. Another car comes up, stops him, holds him at gunpoint. He's back in the car, and they take the back streets to Santa Elena Ranch. There, they feed him eggs, bread, and water, and they keep him in the car for 12 hours until he is brought out of the car, brought to that horrifying shed where he is sodomized and tortured. They then take a machete, they chop his head off. They put his brain in a cauldron. Now, there are a couple of different accounts.
This is insanity.
It's nuts. There's a couple of different accounts, one of which is that they passed this cauldron and consumed it, that there was cannibalism. Other reports say that no cannibalism was found. So it's that I'm not sure. After this, they bury him near the shed, and what they do is they cut off his legs just to make him easier to bury. There's no religious really reason for that. They put a wire through his spine. And the reason they do that is because when the body decomposes, they then can pull out his spine, vertebrae, and bones, and members of the gang can wear them as a talisman for protection. April 11th, Serafin, with his corroborators, mm-hmm. The police take them to the area where he says Mark is buried. The police put a gun on them and say, dig. So these men who buried this body, they say they did not kill him, that it was the godfather, Constanza. But the men start digging, and they find Mark's body. The digging will continue with different members over a couple of days, and they end up finding 14 more bodies.
What?
Different parts of their bodies have been removed.
Taken.
Some of the victims' bodies, their hearts have been gouged out. Some of them are sin genitales, so with no genitals. All of these men, they're all men, they were killed over a period of 9 months. Some of them are rival drug dealers. Some of them are dirty cops. Do you remember I talked about how El Adubi was following a cop and that cop disappeared mm-hmm. earlier? Well, there was a planned execution of a cop. I do not know if it's the same one, but apparently when he was being taken, he pulled out a gun and El Adubi shoots him before the ceremony begins. And so then they don't have a body to sacrifice. And so the cult panics. And three men go out and grab the first person they can find, which is a 14-year-old boy looking for his lost goat. They throw a bag over his head, and similar to Mark, he's decapitated with a machete. And what's crazy is they didn't even look at his face when he was decapitated. And when they took the bag off, it was El Dubi's nephew that that he just executed. Families who had loved ones who are missing were there just waiting to see if their loved ones could be identified. And a lot of them say if it weren't for Mark, none of the other men would have been found and the families would not have been given closure. 3 of the 15 bodies were not identified. April 12th, the detained men were then taken to a press conference. At this point, news has spread of the ritualistic satanic killings and it became a media circus. And there were 250 journalists. And what's wild is the police brings these men who admitted to burying these bodies to participating in the ritualistic murder, and they drag them out on a balcony, and then the press starts asking them questions and they start answering. It's just a press conference where these accomplices are just being interviewed by the press openly. They all credit Constanza with the murder and for guiding them. A Mexican reporter wrote that the young leader of this gang that was answering questions to the press had challenged the comandante, the policeman, to shoot him. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Your bullets will just bounce off, he said. So they're still under the belief that these ritualistic killings,
all these pieces of people's bodies, they're protected.
That they participated.
Boy, are they in for a wild surprise. You are just a cannibal and a murderer.
You're just a fucking murderer. The next day, there was supposed to be a vigil for Mark in the hope that they could bring him home. And that was quickly changed to a memorial service when they found out what happened to him. And I have to reference his parents, who they were devout Catholics, and they spoke to the press on the 13th, just days after they found out what happened to their son. And they said, "I don't feel any anger at all, to be honest with you," his dad said. Added that he hoped that if and when the killers got to heaven, that they would find his son and apologize. His mom asked for people to pray for her son's murderers. That was just shocking to me, that how they, I can't imagine the pain that they must have felt using this moment to ask for prayers for these. It's shocking to me. Mark's parents end up meeting with George H.W. Bush, who is the president at the time, and they start advocating in the drug war. So they say that for every drug consumer, there is a victim who suffers from their addiction. In addition, he stated that drug consumption should be treated with better education and that the use of drugs even casually causes suffering. So it's interesting because later they will create a foundation for Mark. And I think they say the Just Say No. But what was interesting about this is they were still compassionate towards people who are dealing with addiction, right? I was in awe by these parents who deal with mm-hmm. the unimaginable, their grace and I was just gobsmacked. At this point, they still don't have Constanzo, the godfather, and the other cult leaders in police possession. So there's a massive manhunt underway. They think, did he go back home to his mother in Miami? There's some reports that he was in Chicago. He's gone back to the Rio Grande Valley. There were other rumors suggesting that Sarah Aldrete, his accomplice, was spotted in schools throughout the Rio Grande Valley and that she vowed to kidnap children for every jailed cult member. It's May 6th, and the police have been tracking and getting tips from people, right? People mm-hmm. paying for groceries with American money, and they're able to find the car in front of an apartment building. And so the police are able to close in where they think Constanza and some other members of the cult, some higher ups of the cult, are hiding. And so Constanza sees that the police are there, and so he takes his machine gun and he opens fire. When he's about to run out of bullets, he realizes it's done. He starts throwing money off the balcony. He's just doing erratic behavior. And at that point, he asks El Dubi to shoot him and another person. When El Dubi says, "No, I don't want to do that," he threatens him. So El Dubi shoots Constanza and another member of the cult in the closet. And the police are able to arrest El Dubi and Sarah. 14 cult members in total were charged with crimes ranging from murder to drug running and obstructing justice. Sarah Aldrete, Elio Hernandez, who is El Dubi, and Serafine Hernandez were convicted of multiple murders and ordered to serve prison sentences of over 60 years each. El Dubi was given a 30-year term. If Sarah Aldrete is ever released from prison, the American authorities plan to prosecute her for the murder of Mark Kilroy in the U.S. as well. I had mentioned earlier about this shed and how the Mexican authorities were really freaked out by this dark magic that was there, mm-hmm. right? Where these men were sacrificed to the authorities, it remained a citadel of black magic until there was a proper purification ceremony. So one Sunday afternoon when no one was looking, the federales, they slipped out there with a curandero. They went inside the shed. They mumbled incantations. They sprinkled salt on the floor. They made the sign of the cross. They then took gasoline, put it all over the shed, and they burned it to the ground. On the 20th anniversary of Mark's murder, his parents visited the Rio Grande Valley and Matamoros to thank people who had supported them in their search for their son. Kilroy's father stated that people were supportive, and whenever they saw something suspicious, they called the police, and that helped find their son. He said it was easier to overcome their son's death because of the support they received along the way. And that is the story of how the disappearance of Mark Kilroy led to the capture of a satanic cult who was doing satanic ritualistic murders in Mexico.
That's a crazy story. I cannot believe it's real, in the sense that I feel like in America,
Texas
we've done a lot of being like satanic panic. And a lot of inventing things like this. So to have a story where it's like, no, this was happening. Like people were getting targeted, like taken, kidnapped, eaten, and all in the name of witchcraft and magic. It's true. What a wild thing.
And I think, again, that's why the journalist is descended upon this story. But I think what I was interested in this is that within this Mexican culture, right, like I thought that the federales, the Mexican authorities, like they believed it too. I think that's what I think was shocking about this, is that I think that we often will think of these like...
It's very culturally ingrained. It must be.
Yeah. And so the idea of the epilogue of them burning down this shed when no one is looking, like no one sanctioned them to do this, no one asked them to do this, they were like, this cannot stand.
Wow, what a story. Carrie, that's wild. Thank you for sharing it. I know it was a beast to research, and I'm really proud of you.
Thanks. I mean, thank you, Texas Monthly. God, I love that site.
Who wrote
it? Oh, let me see.
You should credit them, because
You should read the story. There's even more details in the article. It was written in 1989 by Gary Cartwright. And wow, it's an incredible, it's truly like, I couldn't do all the information because there's a lot of, you know, but it's fucking insane. Insane. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, dear readers, until next time.
We have to get ready for a very important barbecue.
I mean, we do. And I have to
work. We have to go make the yard look cute.
Okay. I'm work. Oh, shoot. More tickets. Okay. Yeah. I got to go. We got to do it. Goodbye.
We got to go. Goodbye.
Bye, dear readers.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.